to talk about sugar. And although the title here says diet and stress, getting it right, that's sort of an overarching theme. But really, the talk tonight is going to be about sugar and things you don't know about sugar. And always when I do these talks, I find out a lot of things I didn't know about sugar. First, I just want to thank Aaron Evans, who's here with us today from the hospital, sponsoring the talk today. And appreciate having this venue for having the talk. Sugar is something that we all know a lot about, so it seems. This is a staple of our diet, as we might say, and it sort of fit in with a theme that I've sort of put together as salt, sugar, and of course the third one was sex. That's our next lecture, January 25th. And initially I thought that the three topics fit together because they all are basic human, if you will, needs, or I would say drives, okay? There's sort of a physical need, if you will, our biology is based on this. But salt is one of those things that the body has a drive or need for. Sex too, because that's something that we keep in the species going. But sugar actually, it turns out, when I look into it, really isn't something we have a drive for. We don't really need it. And I'll explain why I think that to be the case. Now, here's a book. I've not read this book, although I did do a lot of research in preparing for the talk. In this book, they call us the Sugar Nation. And there's probably some truth to that thought. When we go through the history of sugar, you're going to see why it's become something that's ubiquitous in our country. The average American, according to the United States government agencies, they add up the entire amount of sugar that the country produces and imports in 1 year and divide it by the number of people that live in the country. The number comes to 160 pounds a year. So now this is it's an interesting number. Now some people argue, well, we don't eat that much sugar, but we eat a lot of sugar. Arguably, we eat about 80 pounds of sugar. Why we have 160 pounds for every person on a year's basis in the United States, I'm not exactly sure why that would differ from what we actually eat. But we eat somewhere between 80 and 160 pounds of sugar on average in the United States. It's a pretty wild number when you start thinking about it. You know, we may say that that's, you know, USA sugar nation, but it's not true. England is really the sugar nation, and it's not because in England they eat more sugar than we do. We're probably fairly on a par. Actually, the country that eats the most sugar is Fiji, has the most per person, per capita sugar consumption. But the English brought us sugar, okay, in quantity. You know, when I think of sugar, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, you see the word sugar and people have images that they think of. This is sort of the classic one I would think of, is just a bag of sugar, 5 pound bag. Cane sugar, we're going to talk about the various types of sugar, if there's any difference or not. High fructose corn syrup is a form of sweetener that is a sugar and has gotten a lot of bad press, and maybe much of it doesn't necessarily deserve, although sugar in total may deserve some criticism for sure. Does anybody know what CNH stands for? The native lands of sugar. Does anybody know what native country sugar comes from? California and Hawaii, which are absolutely not native. Sugar is not native to any of those countries. It's an absolute import, of course, and there's virtually nothing native to Hawaii, as we know. This is a teaspoon of sugar, okay? And a teaspoon of sugar, which seems like, oh, that's really very sweet, and I'd never eat, you know, a teaspoon, just plain. Anybody have an idea how many calories are in a teaspoon of sugar? No, that's a heaping teaspoon. 16 is the number I'm going to use because there's 4 calories per gram. There are 4 grams in a teaspoon, 16. So actually, surprisingly, that's a small amount of calories in that teaspoon. But when you realize how much is in like a soda or other things, you realize there are a lot of teaspoons in there. One of the things I think we love about sugar as a general rule, or one of the things that's idealized about sugar, is its purity. And it takes a lot of processing to get sugar to this point. But this is sort of another one of these sort of iconic images, the sugar granule. And an older image, which I don't know if we see this very much, the sugar cube. We do have a natural desire for sweet food, something that tastes sweet. And so we tend to think of sugar as that thing which is sweet, and it certainly exemplifies it. But the reason we like sweet food, and the reason in any country, if you introduce sugar into any country, even if you go to a culture that's never seen sugar before, and you introduce a variety of foods and say, what do you think of this? It turns out every culture like sugar. Every culture is interested in sugar. Every culture wants sugar. You can introduce other foods. There's a great deal of difference culture to culture, you know, whether it's the Fiji Islands, as we mentioned, or Mexico or Europe. Everybody, though, loves sugar. And the reason we have a natural desire for sugar is breast milk is sweet. And breast milk, of course, has, we've heard, lactose. And we're going to talk about what kind of sugar lactose is. It's a special kind of sugar. But this is why we like sugar naturally. And now you might say, well, is breast milk really sweet? Because I drink milk. It's like, that's not sweet. But I was talking to some of the OB nurses, and they're like, oh yeah, breast milk, very sweet. So the babies naturally gravitate toward it, and that's why we love it so much. Now, at the last talk, we talked about the different tastes that are fundamental to all flavors that we enjoy, and they combine to make the entire palette of foods that we eat. The one we talked about last time was salt, okay? Here is on the tongue, this is a tongue, if you will. The sweet taste buds, if you will, are on the front of the tongue. These taste buds, sour and bitter, are probably more meant for avoidance, but they combine to make our foods very interesting. We talked a little bit last time about this flavor, which I think is important for everybody to know because it's sort of the fifth flavor called umami, which is the savory flavor. And I just like to mention it because it's just a great word, umami. And it's probably good in crossword puzzles. I don't know. I don't do crosswords. In these talks, I am a dyed-in-the-wool scientist, if you will. I'm very much a believer in the scientific method. So always like to introduce those concepts here and get us all to be scientists. You know, science is nothing more than just basic logic and straightforward thinking, just brought to bear with a more scrupulous attention to detail and to information. It's a little scary. And of course, you know, you might look at this and go, you know, you might look at this and think, well, that's the way the hospital used to run. How scary and crazy were they? And of course, right now we're doing something equally crazy and scary. Of course, we consider it brilliant. But, you know, in 20 years, we'll look back and go, what was that crazy machine they trotted out? So always with perspective. So here we're going to look at table sugar. Okay, so that's the classic concept of sugar. Okay, and it's a 50-50 split of glucose and fructose. Now, this is where the science comes in. So I'm going to, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about science and about carbohydrates. And these are, this is what's called a disaccharide, or there are two sugar molecules here. And notice the difference. One is red and one is blue. No, just kidding. They're different. In reality, I don't think they're colored. But they're different structures. Okay, these different angles are actually where carbon molecules sit. And that's why when you take sugar and if you burn it, it turns black and looks like coal, to be honest with you. It's because it's got all this carbon in it. So you have sugar. You have sugars made of glucose and fructose, okay? And so to simplify the idea, sugars and starches, because sugars just is directly related to starch, imagine, if you will, that sucrose, what we were just looking at, which is glucose and fructose, is sugar molecules. It's two different, sort of a train and a boxcar, if you will, okay? Now, a starch would be a string of boxcars, okay? So it's the same components, okay? But they're just put together differently, almost like stringing together the alphabet. Now, interestingly, carbohydrates, sugars, are no different than proteins, which are also strung together amino acids, or DNA, which is strung together nucleic acids, okay? But when you put them together, you get different compounds. So I want to show you the structure, if you will, of different forms of carbohydrates, okay? So we have sugar, which is a disaccharide, or two molecules, or two portions of the train, two boxcars. Here we have starch, okay? Now starch would be a potato, or pasta, rice, grains, okay? They're those sugar molecules, okay, drawn differently, but strung together with a bond here that connects them. Notice this. Does anybody know what cellulose is? It's wood pulp, okay? So this is what trees are made of. This is not edible. This is edible. It's very much the same structure. Because the sugars are slightly different, to break that molecule, and to separate them into the individual components, individually, you need a special enzyme. The body has to do something different. Our body cannot do that, okay? Termites can do that. They eat cellulose. So they have an enzyme that breaks this, and they make sugar out of your house, okay? That's what they're doing. They're making simple sugars out of your house. We, on the other hand, can do it with grains and rice and potatoes. Now, here's another starch, complex starch, glycogen. This is actually the storage of starch in our liver. When the body isn't eating sugar and wants to make sugar quick, it has glycogen in it, and it quickly breaks these off, can very rapidly transform this immediately into sugar in the bloodstream. So a single sugar is like the engine, and this is like the glucose. That's a monosaccharide. So we just took that fructose, which was two pieces, and we separated out into one, which is called glucose. And we all heard of glucose, right? That's what you get in the hospital when they give you an IV. And then this is fructose, and you can see the difference. One's six-sided, one's five-sided. Put the two together, you got sucrose, you got table sugar. And this fructose is much sweeter than glucose, as it turns out. And this is the natural sweetness of fruits. Now, just looking at, just want to compare, if you will, again, just how similar these are. They're very different, but similar in so many ways. Sugar, up here, has a glucose and a fructose, okay? Here is lactose, okay? That's a different kind of sugar. It looks very much like glucose, but it's chemically different, and glucose. So it's got galactose and glucose. That makes lactose. So some people say, I'm lactose intolerant. What does that mean? It means I can't break this bond. I don't have the enzyme that cleaves here. Okay, everybody has the enzyme that cleaves here. Everybody can eat sugar and digest it. But some people lack this, or at least after they're a child, after they're a baby, they wean from breast milk, they lose the ability to cleave this. And when this passes through, as we learned in the constipation lecture, this draws in water and it makes the bowels very loose. Here now, here's something near and dear to anybody who likes a malted beverage. Let us say maybe beer or maybe scotch. This is malt. So this is malt sugar. Okay? And interestingly, malt sugar has two glucose molecules, but it's not nearly as sweet as sugar. But it's got twice as much glucose in it. And so where does sugar start? Sugar started actually in Papua New Guinea. It was native to that. And like so many things in this world that we think are, you know, part of our world, it was brought from a small island somewhere, transported over the first centuries of civilization up into 700 AD, where there was some sugar in the Mediterranean region, then into the 1500s, when we'll talk about this. This is when sugar sort of became a big deal. And that's when the English and the Dutch and the Spanish brought the sugarcane from the Mediterranean and planted it in the West Indies and started growing sugar. So that's where sugar comes from. Sugar did not exist fundamentally in ancient Egypt, all right? We may think, well, sugar's been around forever. No, it has not been around forever. It is not like salt, which has been around forever. It has not been around forever. So honey was really the first sweetness, the original sweetener, but it's not as versatile as sugar, so it doesn't have as much to offer. There were other natural sweets, too. People had sweetness in the, you know, ancient days, if you will, but they got them from natural sources of fructose, which were in, like, dates, berries, and grapes. So it was up to the explorers of the 1500s to bring sugar to us into the islands, the West Indies. And here's a map of the area. Now this, for those who like the malted type, actually this is a rum map. It's the best map I could find. But rum and sugar go together. Rum is just a byproduct of the sugar plantations, and they use the sugar in making the alcohol for rum. These are the locations where sugar was grown heavily. And other byproducts, I mentioned rum was one byproduct. Another byproduct of sugar production is molasses, okay, which we all are familiar with. Not a great way to get sweetness. Now, again, not as robust as sugar, as sucrose was. So here's sugar cane. This is what it looks like. And the problem with sugar cane was it has sort of a dirty secret behind it. It required a lot of necessary hard labor to chop it down. And that's why, more than cotton, sugar and slavery go together. This was really the, I couldn't find actual numbers to compare how many slaves were in the South versus how many were in the islands for sugar production. But really, as much as you might think of cotton being sort of the crop of slaves, sugar was really the crop of slaves. And that's because the production of sugar required an enormous amount of human effort to chop it down and so forth. Now, in its original form, I found this great to look at. Has anybody ever seen a real loaf of sugar? I think it's fascinating to see what a loaf looked like. I have no idea why they made them into loaves. I suppose it formed into that as an easy way for transporting it when they produced it. And notice it wasn't very pretty looking either. It sort of had sort of a dirtiness to it. And that's because to really process it heavily, you really need to work the sugar very hard to get that pure crystal white form. Now, and we've heard the term sugar loaf. I just thought it was interesting. Of course, this is Sugarloaf Mountain in Brazil. Here's somebody trying to make homemade sugar loaves. And then there's Sugarloaf Mountain in Vermont. I'm not exactly sure why this, it doesn't even look like a sugar loaf. But I guess maybe that's sugar, like sugar, I don't know. But they call it Sugarloaf Mountain. Now, after sugar cane was developed in the 1500s and the processing was perfected for about 300 years, actually on through today, really. But the beet, the sugar beet, became popular in the 1800s. They really didn't create it. It was actually bred over a few hundred years to get it more sugary, to get it to about 20% sugar. And the other problem with sugar beets was it was very hard to process. They really had a long time in learning how to process. Here's what a sugar beet is. 20% sugar, okay? And of course, sugar beets are farmed in a very different way. I mean, this is sort of a modern way of farming, but it's very difficult to raise a sugar beet on the land. This, in the United States, we're one of the top three sugar beet producing, or sugar producing countries from beets. The capital of sugar production is here in the Thumb of Michigan. That's considered the capital of sugar production, beet sugar production. Notice there's some sugars here. Arizona's here, it looks like it's empty, but right on the border with Yuma, here in Southern California, we could claim it maybe. I'll bet you there's some guys in Yuma growing some sugar. Sugar beet, that is. All right, so Arizona's got this connection with sugar. And of course, you know, grown in quantity, trucked in. This is just the beet production process. We're very, very complicated. You have to turn it into juice, a thick juice, you make it in syrup. It's a very complex process. But notice this graph of sugar consumption in the United Kingdom. Okay? Here's sugar being, here's the sugar consumption in the 1700s, 1800s, 1850, when sugar beets become big and the ability to produce it in large quantity. Notice how it just shoots right up. Okay? So that's sugar production, or consumption, I'm sorry, but that's production follows the consumption, obviously. Okay? And we'll talk a little bit about obesity, which connects to this. So modern sugar looks like this. Okay? It's a giant plant. That's where they make it. Now, sugar in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, used for a variety of things. One of its most important uses, before it became ubiquitous and everywhere, it was a spice. It was used in baking, but only for the very well-to-do. It was also used in medicine to make medicines taste better. That was one thing. But also, I mean, it was used as a medicine itself when there weren't many patented medicines or production medicines that were very useful. And they used to actually have a phrase that apparently was a turn of phrase that was very popular back then was like an apothecary without sugar, somebody who didn't have anything to offer. That's how important sugar was to the pharmacy back then. Sugar was also used to preserve fruits. And we talked about salt being the original preservative. And here, sugar is another important preservative, thus the name preserves. Of course, it makes perfect sense. That's how you could take fruit and make it last after the fresh season. Now, the English were famous for tea. They brought us tea, and the reason I have tea up here, the three brown drinks, if you will, of the 1500s, 1600s, and 1700s, which now, of course, we think of as just commonplace, but again, were exotic, rare, and were very much part of the sugar culture that developed. Tea in the English. Which was second to tea as far as interest among the average population. And then this one, it was a brown liquid. It was mostly a liquid, actually, it was first conceived of. And that's cocoa or chocolate. So really, there were three of these sort of brown liquids at the same time. They were not that appealing to the English or to the European palate, so it required sugar to make them so. Sugar was intimately involved with the development of chocolates, okay? And you laugh and you say, the French. Yeah. Well, the French and the Spanish were big on chocolate with sugar. That's what they were famous for in the 1600s, 1700s. And still today, of course. Keep calm, eat bonbons. You go, I chuckle. When I was a kid, I remember you'd watch TV shows and situation comedies, and they'd always talk about, get her some bonbons. She'll be most pleased with you. I was like, what's a bonbon? I've never seen such a thing, really. But trust me, we have bonbons. The modern bonbon is essentially the Hershey's Kiss. And to talk about how much we do with the Hershey's Kiss, 80 million daily are made, 29 billion yearly consumed. It's a ridiculous sum. We're going to talk about our problem with sugar and with calories. We have a problem in this country. It is a big problem. I'm part of it. I like my sugar. I like my calories, but it's a problem. Now, Italy, they took sugar, put it with ice cream, which was new at the time in the 1700s. So the Italian ice, of course, still very popular, and these look delicious. Americans consume 4 gallons per person per year. So that's, I just did the numbers, that's 1.2 billion gallons of ice cream per year in the United States. You wonder where all that sugar is? That's where it is. I mean, we said there was 80 to 160 pounds of it. So now sugar became very popular because factory workers in the 1800s, they needed quick calories so they could do their work, stay away from the job for just a short time, get a bunch of energy, and go back to work. And so that's why tea became very popular, actually, because they would drink their tea with lots of sugar, they get all these calories, and they could work some more. Here's world sugar consumption, just the trend. It's up. This is the world. Of course, it might be, well, there are more people in the world, of course. There are billions, 7 billion people now. So of course, sugar consumption, true. But total consumption, again, 1900, the average American ate or accounted for 80 pounds of sugar. In 2000, they accounted for 160 pounds of sugar per person. So it's twice as much sugar we're eating as we did in 1900. And remember, in 1600, there was no sugar. And in 1700, there was virtually no sugar. Only in 1850 did they really become sugar. This is an example of China. Their total sugar production is just going up tremendously. So the Chinese, no different than us. This shows different countries. It's a little hard to read, especially from the back, but notice this is kilograms per person. So that's 2 pounds for each kilo, 2.2. So here's the US, let's find us. Here we are, we're in the middle of this group. We're about 80 some odd pounds, as we said. They're sort of guessing low. Here's the European Union, they're a little bit more than us. Fiji's out of sight. Israel, don't ask me, I don't get it. Singapore, I'm guessing it's sugary drinks, but I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to this. And Nepal, they don't eat much sugar, apparently. So now, interestingly, you'd think from what we talked about production, you think, hey, sugar beets, that must be going up and up. No, sugar beet production is flat. Sugar cane continues to rise. I'm not sure where they're growing at all. It's all got to be in temperate climates. But sugar cane is going up. Beets, flat. But truly, calories are going up in the United States. This is part of the problem. The total calorie in sweeteners is going up a bit. Notice that refined sugars down from 1970 to 1985, down, and then flat. But if the total is going up, welcome to the third way we get our sweetener, our sweets, high fructose corn syrup. Now, this is the devil, so to speak, according to some people. But I don't know that that's really true, and I'll tell you why. Because it's really more about the calories. This is just another one that shows us the refined sugars down, corn sweeteners are going up. And here's another way of presenting in the pie graph. Okay, our sugar calories in 2007, very much like today. This is cane and beet. This is high fructose corn syrup. So what we see is total calories going up, cane and beet going down, and high fructose corn syrup going up. But as this high fructose corn syrup goes up, one of the things that it's being blamed for is the total calorie going up. That's not high fructose corn syrup's problem. It's not really the cause of it. The total calories are going up, but it's because the entire pot is getting higher and higher. High fructose is just the less expensive version that's increasing. Now, the one thing that we know sugar causes is this, cavities. Tooth decay, the number one thing. Now, it does cause it, there's no question about it, although historically there was tooth decay before sugar became popular, but it certainly became more important afterwards. And just to give you an idea it's not a pretty sight. I thought I'd wake anybody up who was trying to take a nap right now. So this is a little baby. Now, one of the things that was said, though, I want to actually, just trying to look at my note. This was interesting, that because of how much the English loved their sugar. In the 1500s, a German traveler wrote of the English. He said, he was talking about the queen. He said, she's very majestic at 65, oblong face, fair hair, small eyes, yet she has black teeth, a defect the English are subject to from their great use of sugar. So even back then, the high class people were eating so much sugar as to get black teeth and cavities. But the real problem with sugar is this, okay? Too many calories. This is our problem. This is all of our problem. It really is. We are all eating too many calories. The nation is on the way up with calories on average, just as I told you, 160 pounds of sugar. The average American in 1950 ate 5 pounds of cheese. They now eat 30 pounds of cheese. And you're probably like, yeah, I probably eat my 30 pounds of cheese. I have to say, I eat a lot of, I do eat a lot of cheese. I mean, I'm one of the culprits. Here, of course, if you're on the internet, I always like to throw in something for the people who are cruising the internet. They've probably seen this one, David after visiting America. Not pretty. So, and of course, drink Coke, get fat. And a lot of people like to lay the blame on certain areas like high fructose corn syrup. But it's not the problem. The sugar itself is a problem. It's not specific to high fructose corn syrup. It's any form of sugar. Although there are arguments back and forth, but I'd say it's more about the total calories. So here we're looking at a can of Coke. Now each one of these is a teaspoon. So 4 grams in a teaspoon. We did the numbers. It's a little science here. So 16 calories per teaspoon. There are 140 calories in a 12-ounce can of Coke. Therefore, about 9 teaspoons of sugar in a can of Coke. So it's wild. It's like, boy, that's a lot to dissolve in that. I don't think you could possibly do it yourself at home if you're like, I'm going to dissolve all this sugar into this liquid that I'm drinking. It's like, I don't think you could get 9 teaspoons in. It's hard to do. So high fructose corn syrup, the culprit, more than regular sugar. Here it says high fructose corn syrup. No, this is bad for us. And it's not good. But look at this is really what high fructose corn syrup is. Now remember, we talked about starches and that if you broke them down, you had sugar molecules. And that's all they're doing is they're taking the corn starch and they're breaking it down into glucose and fructose and they're putting it into a form of whether it's, I don't know, I guess it's a liquid. And they're using that as a sweetener. So it's simple to understand the process. Sugarcane naturally produces this disaccharide, or the two sugar molecules together. Corn produces a long starch molecule, but you can process it to get what's called high fructose corn syrup. So notice the sugar, remember, is half glucose, half fructose, 50-50. High fructose corn syrup is just 45% glucose, 55% fructose, that's all. Now, fructose is much sweeter than glucose, so this is much sweeter than sugar, ounce for ounce. But that's the only difference. It's not that huge. Now notice that the number of people with diabetes increases here in the United States, okay? So we see this enormous problem. So diabetes is on the way up in the United States, as we've all heard, and it's all related to the amount of calories, and we'll see this here in this graph. This is, here's the percent of people in the United States who are obese as it's graphed here, and here's diabetes on the way up. And if we look at a map, here's the obesity map, and here's the diabetes map over time. Red is not good, okay? And they don't overlap exactly, but they follow each other pretty closely, okay? So over time, as we're getting fatter, there's more diabetes. And this is the big problem, more calories. Sugar itself is not the problem per se, it's the total calories, the fact that we're becoming overweight, and that diabetes is then developing as a result of that. I do want to talk a little bit about diabetes. And in 1921, Warren G. Harding was a president. The gummy bear was invented. This is sort of the styles of the day. And this is what diabetes was. Diabetes was this child right here, or this child here, starting, gets diabetic here. The diagnosis of diabetes of a child, now this is different than the overweight diabetic, but I want to just talk about this just to understand sort of the history of diabetes, sort of get an idea of what happened in the past and what can happen today, good and bad. 1 year was the life expectancy of a child diagnosed with diabetes. Every child would be dead in 1 year. That was the work of Dr. Jocelyn in Boston. He did meticulous statistical analysis, kept track of all of his diabetic patients. He absolutely concluded it was 1 year. That was all they could live with diabetes. Now, there was this fellow. He looks intense. He looks almost like Houdini did back then, yeah. A little bit of a Houdini look. The Allen diet, Dr. Allen, out of New York, he had a sanatorium where he had a diet in which the amount of carbohydrates the children would be given was 4 grams, 20 grams. I mean, this is, 16 to 80 calories of sugar or of carbohydrate. That's all starch in per day. That's how little. And and the calorie count would be 400 to 800 calories a day. And by doing this, he could actually stop the diabetes from killing the kids, but they'd slowly starve to death, okay? And people thought he was a nut because, he was starving people, basically. But he was like, it's either that or they die in a year. Of course, people were like, they didn't know the data. They didn't believe that people died in a year, but that was absolute data. So this was the only treatment. And it took none other than the Canadians to help us out with this one. It took a Canadian. Now, it wasn't these most famous Canadians. In Canada, these are probably the most famous Canadians, Michael Fox. And I like Michael Fox, great movies. Justin Bieber, I don't know about. I'm not a big fan, but what can I say? It really was these two fellows, Charles Best and Frederick Banting. Banting and Best in 1922. By experimenting with dogs and building on others' research, they were basically able to isolate insulin. Really a tremendous work for which Banting and McCollum, or I can't remember who else, they shared the Nobel Prize. He was the youngest Nobel Prize winner ever, 34 years old, for isolating insulin. Best did not get it. He got the money, but he didn't get the award. Here's the original article describing this, 1922, February, the internal secretions of the pancreas. And what they did was they identified, purified and used it first as a medication, first in the dog, and then they used it in humans very quickly. And you can imagine, if you will, try and imagine 1922, you have a kid or you know somebody or whatever, they've been diagnosed with diabetes, you know they're going to be dead in a year. I mean, that you would do anything to get to Toronto to get that. And this is the difference that 1 year made in that research and those researchers made. This to this, this to this. And these people would then live, most of them would live, many of them into their 60s and 70s. And it was the difference between being diagnosed that year and being able to make it through and not. But the other town that was important for those of you Hoosiers out there was Indianapolis. And Lilly Pharmaceutical, did an amazing amount of work on the development of the production of insulin. These guys isolated, but they could not make it in any kind of quantity. Now, Lilly was famous for developing this, the gelatin capsule. Aside from sugar making medicines more palatable, the gelatin capsule was a huge boon in the late 1800s, 1894, they invented the gelatin capsule. And that's why, actually, if you see a Lilly pills, they're mostly in capsules, interestingly. This is their headquarters now. But they worked with Banting and Best and that group to develop an industrialized process for making insulin in quantity. Originally, it took 2 tons of pancreas to get a bottle of insulin. That's the kind of work they had to do. So they went out to all the abattoirs, all the meat packers in the area, and had to have it shipped in mass quantity to get this done. Fascinating. Modern insulin production is done in these kind of vats. It's just tremendous, the difference. This is recombinant bioreactors in which yeast have a gene from the human inserted into them, and then the yeast produce the insulin, and then they process it to remove it. I mean, think of the difference between 2 tons of pancreas and this sort of sleek and stylized production facility. I did want to draw my little name into the equation on the history here. Banting and Best gave Elliot Joslin the first insulin to give any American. My dad worked with Joslin in his later years. And then there's me. Here's a little picture. I always love these goofball pictures. So this is why I was not supposed to eat sugar. Sugar is not the culprit as much as the quantity of sugar that we're eating. And when you realize how much sugar you are eating and how many calories we're all eating, we need to rethink our diet, just as when we talked about salt last time, we talked about how ubiquitous it is and how it's not natural to be in the quantities it is in our diet, so too sugar is not natural in the quantities it is. So we need to do our part to limit our sugar. And that's it for the lecture. That's it. Thank you, everybody.